Torts, 15H Edition, Chapter 2. Intentional Interference with Person or Property. Narration script for audio conversion. This script is written as continuous spoken narration rather than as an outline. It is organized in two parts. Part 1 narrates the non-case material in the chapter, the explanatory text and restatement provisions that introduce each of the chapter's 9 sections. Part 2 narrates the cases section by section, each presented first with a person or their property, intent itself, battery, assault, false imprisonment, intentional infliction of emotional distress, trespass to land, trespass to tation liability for aiding, abetting, or conspiring in another's tort.
Part 1, the framework of intentional torts. It helps to understand what intent means in tort law because that single concept runs through every cause of action in this chapter. The most recent restatement of torts defines intent this way. A person acts with the intent to produce a consequence if the person acts with the purpose of producing that consequence, or if the person acts knowing that the consequence is substantially certain to result. In other words, intent in tort law does not require to cause harm. It's enough that the actor either wanted the consequence to happen, or knew to a substantial certainty that it would happen as a result of what they were doing. A mere awareness that harm is possible, or even probable, is not enough. The outcome must be substantially certain to result.
And that substantial certainty standard is meant to be limited to situations where the defendant is certain that a particular victim, or a small and identifiable class of potential victims, will be affected. Not situations of merely elevated general risk. It also matters what consequence the law requires the defendant to have intended. That turns out to depend on which specific tort is at issue. For battery, is it enough that the defendant intended to touch the plaintiff, or must the defendant and subjectively meant by it? A minority of courts require dual intent. The defendant must have intended both the contact and that the contact be harmful or offensive. This distinction can be outcome determinative. Imagine a man who genuinely, if foolishly, believes that any woman would welcome an unsolicited kiss from him, and he kisses a stranger at a party. In a single intent jurisdiction, he might escape liability, because he did not intend to offend or harm her. Two further doctrines recur throughout this chapter. The first is transferred intent. If a defendant intends to commit one of 5 historically related torts, battery, assault, false imprisonment, trespass to land, or trespass to chattels, against one person, but instead ends up committing that tort, or a different one among those 5, against someone else, the defendant's intent transfers to the actual victim, and the defendant is liable just as if the intended target had been struck. The second doctrine concerns mistake. Generally, an honest and even reasonable mistake does not negate intent. If a hunter shoots what he reasonably believes to be a wolf, but which is actually someone's dog, he still intended to shoot and kill the animal he saw. He was simply mistaken about whose animal in identifying the man. Had to the way, and in hadn, action, tame, command one shat. There are, kind of man, tame, to.
Second e-by, second narration, comes to crer. Section 1 of this chapter uses 5 cases to explore intent means in practice, for very young children, for people with mental illness, for defendants who miss their intended target, and for defendants who honest mistake about who or what they're dealing with. Case, Garrett v. Daly, Washington, 1955. Summary, Ruth Garrett, an adult, was about to sit down in a lawn chair in her sister's backyard. Brian Daly, a boy not yet 6 years old, was also in the yard. The trial court believed Brian's version of events, that he moved the chair away and sat in it himself, then noticed Ruth about to sit down where the chair used to be, and tried, but, because of a small size, failed, to get the chair back under her in time.
Ruth fell and fractured her hip. The trial court found that Brian had no intent to injure her or play a prank, and entered judgment for Brian. Ruth appealed. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a battery can be established even without any purpose to injure, embarrass, or play a trick on the plaintiff, so long as the defendant knew with substantial certainty that the plaintiff would attempt to sit down where the chair had been. The rule the Washington Supreme Court applied was that battery requires the intentional infliction of a harmful bodily contact, and that this intent element is satisfied not only when the defendant desires the contact, but also when the defendant knows, to a substantial certainty, that the plaintiff would attempt to sit down where the chair had been. The rule the Washington Supreme Court applied was that battery requires the intentional infliction of a harmful bodily contact, and that this intent element is satisfied not only when the defendant desires the contact, but also when the defendant knows to a substantial certainty that the plaintiff would attempt to sit down where the chair had been. The rule the Washington Supreme Court applied was that battery requires the intentional infliction of a harmful bodily contact, and that this intent element is satisfied not only when the defendant desires the contact, but also when the defendant knows to a substantial certainty that the contact will result from the act. Here, moving the chair is Nane Morans. Applying that rule, the court explained that the trial court's findings did not yet resolve the key factual question. Did Brian know, at the moment he moved the chair, that Ruth would try to sit down where it had been? If he did have that knowledge, the absence of any intent to injure, embarrass, or trick her would not matter. The substantial certainty knowledge would itself supply the necessary intent. If he did not have that knowledge, there was no wrongful act at all, and no liability. The court's conclusion was to remand the case back to the trial court for a specific finding on that narrow question of Brian's actual knowledge at the time, noting that Brian's young age was relevant only to what he actually understood at the time, not as a separate legal shield from liability. Case: Wagner v. State, UDA, 2005. Summary: Mrs. Wagner was standing in line at a Kmart when she was suddenly attacked from behind by a mentally disabled man named Mr. Geese, who was there with state employees supervising him as part of his treatment program. He grabbed her hair and threw her to the ground. The Wagner state for negligent supervision, but the state argued that the attack was actually a battery, a carry of claim for which the state was sovereign immunity. The case therefore turned on a seemingly narrow but consequential question. What kind of intent does battery require? Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether battery requires that the actor appreciate that his contact is harmful or offensive, or whether it's enough that the actor merely intended to make the contact at all. The rule the Utah Supreme Court adopted, following the restatement and the weight of authority nationally, was the single intent rule. A battery requires only that the contact be deliberate, and that the contact be harmful or offensive as an objective, legal matter. The actor need not personally recognize or intend that the contact would be harmful or offensive. Applying that rule to the facts, the court found that there was no allegation that Mr. Geese's attack was an involuntary muscle spasm. He deliberately grabbed and threw Mrs. Wagner, and that contact was plainly harmful and unconsented to. That was enough to satisfy the intent element of battery, regardless of whether Mr. Geese's attack was an involuntary muscle spasm. He deliberately grabbed and threw Mrs. Wagner, and that contact was plainly harmful and unconsented to. That was enough to satisfy the intent element of battery, regardless of whether Mr. Geese's, given his mental disability industry, have to be other fans. Geese's attack legally constituted a battery, which meant it fell within the state's retained sovereign immunity, and the Wagner's suit against the state was properly dismissed, an outcome the court candidly acknowledged was an unfortunate result of the legislature's immunity choices, but one the court felt bound to follow rather than override. Case: McGuire v. Almy, Massachusetts, 1937. Summary: The plaintiff was a registered nurse hired to provide round-the-clock care for the defendant, a woman suffering serious mental illness. One day, while locked in her room during a violent episode, the defendant destroyed furniture and threatened to kill anyone who entered. When the plaintiff and others looked in, they saw the defendant standing in the middle of the room holding up the leg of a broken piece of furniture as if to strike. The plaintiff nonetheless walked toward the defendant to try to take the weapon from her hand, and the defendant struck her in the head with it, causing the injuries at issue in the suit. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue rules whether and under what circumstances a person suffering from serious mental illness can be held liable for an intentional tort in the same way a mentally competent person would be. The rule the Massachusetts court announced was that an insane person who intentionally causes harm to another is liable in the same circumstances a normal person would be, meaning the plaintiff must still show that the defendant's judgment to be distorted. Applying that rule, the court found the evidence sufficient for the jury to conclude that the defendant was capable of entertaining, and did entertain, an intent to strike and injure the plaintiff when she swung the furniture leg, and that this was legally sufficient to establish battery, notwithstanding her mental illness. The court's conclusion affirmed judgment for the plaintiff, while sending back for the jury to weigh a separate question, whether the plaintiff, an experienced caretaker who had looked after the defendant without incident for 14 months, had assumed the risk of an attack by choosing to approach a visibly violent patient, a question the court held could not be resolved as a matter of law in the defendant's favor. Case, Talmadge v. Smith, Michigan, Hasten, Aspects. Before they could climb down, the defendant threw a stick at one of those two boys to hasten them along. The stick missed its target and instead struck the plaintiff, a different boy the defendant apparently had not even seen, above the eye, causing him to lose the sight in that eye. The defendant later admitted he had thrown the stick intending to hit one of the two boys he could see. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a defendant who intends to strike one person, but instead unintentionally strikes a different person entirely, can be held liable to the person actually struck. The rule the Michigan Supreme Court applied and the trial judge had properly instructed the jury on was the doctrine of transferred intent. If a defendant intends to use force against one person, and that force, instead or in addition, lands on someone else, the defendant's intent transfers to the person actually struck, and the defendant is liable for that injury, provided the force used would have been excessive or unreasonable even against the intended target. Applying that rule, the court found that the jury had been correctly instructed to ask whether the defendant intended to hit one of the two boys he saw, and whether that level of force was unreasonable under the circumstances. And, if so, the fact that the stick instead struck an unseen bystander did not relieve the defendant of liability. The court's conclusion affirmed the judgment for the plaintiff. The resulting injury to a different, unintended victim does not excuse the defendant, because the law transfers the wrongful intent from the intended target to the person actually harmed. Case, Ransom v. Kittner, Illinois, 1889. The rule the Illinois Appellate Court applied was that a defendant is liable for the consequences of an intentional act even when the defendant is honestly and reasonably mistaken about a fact. Here, mistaken about whether the animal was a wolf or a pet dog, because the defendant nonetheless intended to shoot and kill this animal in front of him. Applying that rule, the court found no error in the jury's verdict. The defendants clearly intended to shoot and kill the animal they saw, and their good faith belief that it was a wolf rather than a dog did not change the fact that they intentionally killed someone else's property. The court's conclusion affirmed the judgment for the plaintiff, establishing the enduring principle that mistake as to identity generally does not negate intent. A defendant may still be liable even while acting in complete good faith. During an unannounced fire drill at a high school, a teacher named Rosen was moving a crowded stairwell trying to keep students moving in an orderly way. She came upon Wallace, an adult visitor who was standing with her back turned near the top of the stairs, unable to hear Rosen over the fire alarm. Rosen touched Wallace's back to get her attention and told her to keep moving. Wallace testified that Rosen actually pushed her, causing her to fall down the stairs. Rosen denied pushing her but admitted touching her back.
At trial, the judge refused to give the jury a requested instruction on civil battery, and the jury found for the teacher and the school. Appealed the refusal to give that instruction. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether the evidence, viewed favorably to the trial court's ruling, was sufficient to require a battery instruction. In other words, whether a reasonable jury could have found that Rosen's touch was a rude, insolent, or angry manner, but the reasonableness of a touching must be judged in light of the setting, being crowded, fast-moving environment, a certain amount of incidental contact is expected and not actionable, and absent sensible battery is the knowing or intentional touching of another in a rude, insolent, or angry manner, but the reasonableness of a touching must be judged in light of the setting people available to the defendant. The standard is what would offend an ordinary person.
Applying that rule to a chaotic fire drill on a crowded stairwell, the court found that a teacher lightly touching someone's shoulder or back with her fingertips, simply to get her attention over the noise of the alarm and keep the evacuation moving, could not reasonably be characterized as rude, insolent, or angry, even though the contact ultimately led to a fall and real physical injury. The court's conclusion affirmed the trial court's refusal to give the battery instruction. Given the crowded, urgent circumstances, no reasonable jury could find the touch itself to have been an offensive or angry contact, so the case was correctly decided as a matter of ordinary negligence rather than intentional battery. Case made by Nitea finding Pry, saying, I need 10 for re, plain mean, pi 3, context, actress, there, yes. The plaintiff, a NASA mathematician attending a professional conference at the defendant's hotel, was standing in a buffet line when a hotel employee approached him, snatched the plate directly from his hand, and shouted that a Negro could not be served in a club. The plaintiff was never physically touched himself and felt no fear of physical injury, but he was deeply humiliated in front of his professional colleagues. A jury awarded him $400 in actual damages for humiliation and indignity, plus $500 in damages, but the trial court set the verdict aside and entered judgment for the hotel notwithstanding the verdict, a ruling the intermediate appellate court affirmed. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether snatching an object out of someone's hand, without ever touching the person's body directly, can constitute a battery, and whether a plaintiff can recover damages for humiliation and indignity even without any physical injury to the body. The rule the Texas Supreme Court applied was that a battery does not require contact with a person's actual body, grabbing something so closely connected to a person that it is, in effect, part of them. Here, a plate the plaintiff was actively holding is just as clearly an offensive invasion of the person as direct bodily contact would be. The court further held that where a battery is willful, damages for mental suffering are recoverable even without any physical injury at all, because the essence of battery is the unpermitted and intentional invasion of personal dignity, not merely physical harm to the body. Applying that rule, the court found that the intentional, forcible snatching of the plate, accompanied by a racist insult delivered in front of the plaintiff's colleagues, was a clear, willful battery, and that the resulting humiliation was compensable in its own right. The court's conclusion reversed the judgment below and reinstated the jury's award for the plaintiff, holding him liable for its employee's actions. Pen 3-3. Ass assault off to college, R. Langle. Asses as the tort of intentionally causing another person to reasonably anticipate imminent harmful or offensive contact. It protects against the fear or apprehension of an imminent battery, whether or not the contact actually happens. Case, I just say, U.S.A.U.S. A man came to a tavern at night wanting to buy wine, found the door shut, and struck the door with a hatchet he was carrying. When the tavern keeper's wife put her head out the window and told him to stop, he swung the hatchet at her, but missed, doing her no physical harm at all. A jury initially concluded there was no liability, reasoning that since no harm was actually done, there was nothing to compensate. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a defendant can be liable in damages for an attack that puts the victim in fear of being struck, even though the blow never actually lands and no physical harm results. The rule the court announced, remarkably for the very first time in the reported history of English law, was that harm can consist of the trespass itself, meaning the act of making the assault upon the victim and making to a tavern at night, wanting to buy wine, found the door shut and struck the door with a hatchet he was When the tavern keeper's wife put her head out the window and told him to stop, he swung the hatchet at her, but missed, doing her no physical harm at all. Applying that rule to the facts, the court found that swinging the hatchet at the woman, even though it missed her entirely, was itself the wrongful act, an assault upon her, for which she was entitled to be compensated. The court's conclusion awarded the plaintiff's damages, establishing for the first time the principle that has governed the law of assault ever since. A person can recover for the fear of being struck, entirely apart from whether the strike itself succeeds or fails. Case Haas, Western Union Telegraph Co. v. Hill, Alabama, 1933. Summary. The plaintiff's wife went to the defendant telegraph office to ask why an electric clock hadn't yet been repaired as promised. The company's local manager, Sapp, who had been drinking, stood behind a counter roughly waist high and told her that if she would come behind the counter and let him love and pet, Hauer and Maud alive and Ember Cullman, 10, love and one. She jumped back. There was conflicting evidence about whether Sapp, given the height and width of the counter, could actually have reached far enough to touch her even if he tried. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether an offer to touch someone, made under circumstances that create a reasonable fear of imminent contact, constitutes an actionable assault even though the person never was actually touched. And specifically, whether it mattered that physical obstacles might, in fact, have prevented the defendant from actually reaching her. The rule the Alabama court applied was that an assault requires an intentional, unlawful offer to touch another person in a rude or angry manner, under circumstances creating in the mind of the person a well-founded fear of an imminent battery, coupled with the apparent, not necessarily actual, present ability to carry out the attempt. Applying that rule, the court found that even though the counter's height and width raised a genuine factual question about whether Sapp could physically have reached Mrs. Hill, There was also testimony that he might have been able to reach 6 to 18 inches beyond the counter. Enough, combined with his words and his outstretched hand, to create a jury question as to whether she reasonably believed an imminent, unwanted touching was about to occur. The court's conclusion was that this question of apparent ability and reasonable fear was properly left to the jury, and the trial court's rulings on that issue contained no error, though the court ultimately reversed the judgment on a separate ground, finding that Sapp's conduct fell outside the scope of his employment, so his employer, the telegraph company, could not be held liable for it.
False imprisonment requires that the defendant intend to confine the plaintiff within a limited area, that the plaintiff actually be confined, and that the plaintiff be aware of the confinement or be harmed by it. This section's four cases explore what counts as confinement, what counts as consent to stay, and what happens when confinement is carried out under a false claim of legal authority. Case: Big Town Nursing Home, E. Newman, Texas, 1970.
The nursing home staff refused to let him use the phone, locked away his belongings, and when he simply walked out, physically caught him and forcibly brought him back. He was placed in a locked wing housing patients described by the home's own administrator as senile, addicted, mentally disturbed, and uncontrollable, tried to escape 5 or 6 more times, and on at least one occasion was strapped into a restraint chair for more than 5 hours. He went 10 days without being seen by a doctor. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a nursing home that physically restrains and confines a competent, voluntarily admitted resident against his express wishes, despite promising in its own admission papers that it would not do so, is liable for false imprisonment. The rule is that false imprisonment requires an unlawful restraint of a person against his will, and that restraint may be accomplished either by physical force or by words the person reasonably fears to disregard. Applying that rule to these facts, the court found the case about as clear an example of unlawful confinement as one could ask for. The plaintiff had been promised he would not be held against his will. He wished to leave unmistakably clear on multiple occasions, and the home responded not with persuasion but with physical force, confiscation of his belongings, confinement in a locked ward alongside dangerous patients, and physical restraint in a chair for hours at a time. The court's conclusion affirmed liability for false imprisonment along with actual and exemplary damages, making clear that a facility cannot lawful imprisonment of physical force, confiscation of his belongings, confinement in a locked ward alongside dangerous patients, and the save faces that were just belonging and attainment in my conflict, they're alive and pointer from Allah. That's in place and it requires an unlawful restraint of a person against his will, and that restraint may be accomplished either by physical force or by words the person reasonably fears to disregard. The plaintiff had been promised he would not be held against his will. He made his wish to leave unmistakably clear on multiple occasions, and the home responded not with persuasion but with physical force, confiscation of his belongings, confinement in a locked ward alongside dangerous, and physical restraint in a chair for hours at a time. The court's conclusion affirmed liability for false imprisonment along with simply because it believes doing so is in his best interest. Police responding to a disturbance found the plaintiff with 2 brothers who were quarreling in an alley. All 3 showed signs of intoxication. Rather than arrest the plaintiff, who said he had nowhere to go, the officers drove him outside city limits to an abandoned golf course used as an informal spot to let intoxicated people dry out. Within about an hour, the plaintiff had wandered onto a nearby highway and was struck by a car and severely injured. At trial on cross-examination, he admitted he had no independent memory of the events of that night, including how or why he ended up in the police car. The trial court dismissed his false imprisonment claim, and the intermediate appellate court affirmed. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a plaintiff's later loss of memory about being confined defeats a false imprisonment claim, given that one required element of the tort is that the plaintiff be conscious of the confinement at the time it occurred. The rule requires the plaintiff to prove 4 things, that the defendant intended to confine him, that the plaintiff was conscious of the confinement, that the plaintiff did not consent, and that the confinement was not privileged. But critically, the consciousness requirement asks whether the plaintiff was aware of the confinement while it was happening, not whether he can still recall that awareness at trial. Applying that rule, the New York Court of Appeals found that the plaintiff's later inability to remember the incident was not the same as an absence of awareness at the time, and pointed to substantial evidence, including the plaintiff's responsiveness to police commands and his own contemporaneous request to be dropped off somewhere else, suggesting he was indeed conscious of his confinement as it was happening. even if alcohol and his later injuries had since erased his memory of it. The court's conclusion reversed the dismissal and remanded the case for a new trial, holding that it was for the jury, not the court, to weigh the credibility of the evidence and decide whether the plaintiff had in fact been conscious of the confinement at the relevant time. Case, The Bulls Distributing Co., Montana, 1983. The next morning, the plaintiff was told all new employees received an office tour, led into the showroom manager's office, and then left there with the store's loss prevention manager and a uniformed police officer, where she was accused of the theft. She denied it and voluntarily agreed to take a polygraph test. The meeting lasted somewhere between 20 and 45 minutes. The polygraph supported her denial. The store apologized, and she was told she was still welcome to work there. She sued for false imprisonment based on the initial meeting in the manager's office, issue rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether the plaintiff was restrained against her will during the meeting in the manager's office, given that she was never explicitly told she could not leave, was not physically restrained against her will during the meeting in the manager's office, issue rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether the plaintiff was restrained against her will during the meeting in the manager's office, issue rule, at place of was told all new employees received an office tour, Mrs. Running Manager, and a uniformed police officer, where she was accused of the theft. She denied it and voluntarily agreed to take a polygraph test. The meeting lasted somewhere between 20 and 45 minutes. The polygraph supported her denial, the store applauses trying against her will during the meeting in the manager's office, issue rule, applicant's office, and then left there with the store's loss prevention manager and a uniformed police officer, where she was accused of the theft. She denied it and voluntarily agreed to take a polygraph test. The meeting lasted somewhere between 20 and 45 minutes. The polygraph supported her denial. The store apologized and she was told she was still welcome to work there. The rule requires both an actual restraint of the individual against her will and that the restraint be unlawful. Restraint that can be accomplished by physical acts or merely by words the person fears to disregard, but which requires some genuine compulsion, not just an uncomfortable social situation the plaintiff chose to remain in. Applying that rule, the court found ample evidence supporting the jury's conclusion that the plaintiff was not unlawfully restrained. She never asked to leave, was never told she could not leave, faced no threat of force, and by her own testimony would have willingly followed the assistant manager into the office even if she had known its true purpose and that police officers were present. The court's conclusion confirmed the judgment for the defendant, illustrating that persuading someone to stay, or even placing her in an uncomfortable situation she'd rather not be in, is not the same as confining her against her will. Actual restraint, or a well-founded fear of consequences for leaving, is required. Case, Enright v. Groves, Hay Clans to Lolo Cage, tax the fine of family confusion like this, and later convicted of that ordinance violation after posting bail. She sued for false imprisonment, and the defendants argued that her subsequent conviction on the dog leash charge was a complete defense. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a person's later conviction for the offense underlying a purported arrest defeats a false imprisonment claim, when the officer's actual stated reason for the arrest at the time was something else entirely. Here, refusal to produce a driver's license rather than the leash violation itself. The rule is that a valid arrest or an arrest based on probable cause for the offense actually charged is a defense to false imprisonment claim, when the officer's actual stated reason for the arrest at the time was something else entirely. Here, refusal to produce a driver's license rather than the leash violation. Applying that rule, the court found that the officer had explicitly told the plaintiff she would go to jail unless she produced her driver's license, not for violating the leash law, and that there was no legal requirement that a pedestrian, as opposed to a driver, produce identification on demand. Because the arrest was actually made in real time for an unlawful reason having nothing to do with the leash ordinance, her later conviction on the unrelated leash charge could not retroactively justify the arrest that had actually occurred. The court's conclusion affirmed the jury's verdict for the plaintiff on her false imprisonment claim, holding that an officer's demand for identification without lawful basis, backed by a threat of arrest, was not a lawful order, and using force to enforce it constituted an unlawful confinement.
Annotation 5, ENT, intentional infliction of emotional distress, requalident intentional infliction of emotional distress. Requalid intentional infliction of emotional distress requires extreme and outrageous conduct that doesn't fit neatly into the older, more established intentional torts like assault or battery. Case State Rubbish Collectors S.N.V. Selesnov, California, 1952. Summary. Seleznov, a trash collector, had picked up business from a brewing company that a trade association believed belonged to one of its other members.
He was summoned before the association's board and told he would be beaten up, have his truck's tires cut or his truck burned, and be put out of business entirely if he did not either join the association and pay for the disputed account, or show up and reach some agreement at that night's meeting. Frightened, he attended the meeting, was pressured for 2 more hours, and ultimately signed promissory notes to resolve the dispute, motivated, by his own account, primarily by fear of the threatened violence. He later became physically ill from the fright, vomiting repeatedly and missing several days of work. When the association sued to collect on the notes, he counterclaimed for damages based on the threats made against him. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a defendant can be held liable for intentionally causing another person severe fright and emotional distress through serious threats of physical violence, even where the threatened violence was not so imminent as to legally qualify as a technical assault. And even though the defendant's aggressive method, no physical touching but psychological coercion, did not neatly fit any previously recognized tort, the rule the California Supreme Court adopted, extending the language of the restatement, was that a cause of action is established whenever a defendant, without privilege, intentionally subjects another to the mental suffering that accompanies serious threats to his physical well-being, whether or not those threats are made under circumstances technically amounting to assault. Applying that rule to the facts, the court found that the association's threats of physical beating, of destroying his truck, and of putting him out of business entirely were calculated to, and did in fact, produce genuine and serious fright. Fright severe enough to make him physically ill, and that the association had no legitimate privilege to use such coercive tactics simply because it was competing with him for business. The court's conclusion affirmed the judgment in Seleznov's favor, formally recognizing for the first time in California that intentionally causing someone severe emotional distress through outrageous conduct is itself an independent, actionable tort, even without any accompanying physical touching or technical assault. Case: Slocum v. Food Fair Stores of Florida, Florida, 1950, Tations of 3010 men of their Macrosses. He responded rudely. If you want to know the price, you'll have to find out the best way you can. You stink to me. The plaintiff claimed this insult caused her severe emotional distress, a heart attack, and an aggravation of a pre-existing heart condition. The trial court dismissed her complaint for failing to state a valid legal claim, and she appealed. Issue, rule, application, conclusion. The issue was whether a rude and insulting remark by a store clerk, with no threat of physical harm, no touching, and no ongoing course of harassment, is legally sufficient, by itself, to state a claim for the intentional infliction of severe emotional distress. The rule, drawing on the general national trend recognizing this developing tort, requires conduct exceeding all bounds that could be tolerated by a decent society, of a nature especially calculated to cause serious mental damage, judged from an objective standard rather than the plaintiff's own particular sensitives. Applying that rule, the court found that a rude and insulting, even vulgar, remark from a store clerk, however unpleasant, simply did not rise to the level of outrageousness the tort requires. It was at most an example of the ordinary friction and insult that people are expected to tolerate as part of living in a community, not the kind of extreme calculated cruelty that the emerging tort was designed to address. The court's conclusion affirmed the dismissal, holding that mere insulting language, without more, does not constitute the outrageous conduct necessary to sustain a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And the court notably declined, at that time, to even formally decide whether Florida would recognize the tort at all, a step Florida's courts would not take for almost another 30 years. Case: Harris v. Jones, 1977. Summary. William Harris, a longtime General Motors employee who had stuttered his entire life and was known to be sensitive and insecure about the condition, worked for several months under a supervisor named Jones. Over that period, Jones approached more than 30 times at work, verbally and physically mimicking his stutter, and repeatedly told him, in a mocking manner, not to get nervous. When Harris asked for a transfer, Jones called him a troublemaker and again mocked his stutter while denying the request. Harris testified the harassment left him feeling humiliated and made him want to hide, and that it worsened his pre-existing nervous condition and his stutter, though the medical evidence of that worsening was thin. A jury awarded him both compensatory and substantial punitive damages against Jones and General Motors. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether the evidence was legally sufficient to support a jury finding on all four elements of intentional infliction of emotional distress, intentional or reckless conduct, extreme and outrageous conduct, a causal connection, and severe emotional distress, with the case turning specifically on the fourth element. The rule requires the plaintiff to prove that the emotional distress he suffered was not upsetting but severely disabling. Severity is not just relevant to how much the plaintiff can recover. It's a necessary element of the claim in the first place. Applying that rule, the Maryland Court of Appeals assumed, without needing to decide, that Jones's conduct was both intentional and extreme and outrageous, and instead focused on whether Harris's actual emotional response met the severity threshold. The court found the evidence on that point thin and equivocal. Harris admitted many things, including ordinary workplace stress, made him nervous. His underlying nervous condition and family problems predated his encounters with Jones, and the extent to which his stutter actually worsened, and by how much, was never clearly established. The court's conclusion affirms judgment for the defendants, holding that even genuinely cruel and reprehensible conduct does not support liability for intentional infliction of emotional distress unless the plaintiff can also show that the resulting distress was severe. Not merely real, but severe as a matter of degree. Case. Taylor v. Valenga, Plaintiffs Compressed, Taylor v. Valenga, California 1959-. Summary. The plaintiff's father was beaten by the defendants. The plaintiff, his daughter, was beaten by the defendants. The plaintiff, his daughter, witnessed the reasons including ordinary workplace stress, made him nervous. His underlying nervous condition and family problems predated his encounters with Jones. And the extent to which his stutter actually worsened and by how much was never clearly established. The court found the evidence on that point thin and equivocal. Harris admitted many things, including ordinary workplace stress, made him nervous. His unraised plaintiff can also the times and the extent to which his stutter actually worsened and by how much was never clearly established. The court from prover of Ramon of Tomonics worsened his time my am. Critically, her complaint did not allege that the defendants knew she was present and watching, nor that they beat her father for the purpose of causing her distress, nor that they knew such distress was substantially certain to result from what they were doing to her father in her presence. The trial court sustained a demurrer to her claim, and when she declined to amend her complaint to add those missing allegations, the case was dismissed. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a bystander who witnesses a beating inflicted on a family member can recover for intentional infliction of emotional distress without alleging that the defendant knew of, or intended to exploit, her presence as a witness. The rule requires that the defendant's intent to cause severe emotional distress exists either because the act was done for the specific purpose of causing that distress, or because the defendant knew, to a substantial certainty, that severe emotional distress would result from the conduct. And where a third party witnesses harm inflicted on someone else, the defendant's awareness of that third party's presence is essential to establishing this intent as to the witness specifically. Applying that rule, the court found the complaint fatally deficient. We had never alleged that the defendants knew the daughter was present and watching the beating, nor that the beating was murder to cause her distress, nor that the defendants knew the daughter was present and watching the beating, nor that the beating was carried out in order to concepts to the defendant's intent to cause severe emotional distress, as the defendant's intent to cause severe emotional distress exist either because the act was done for the specific purpose of causing that distress, or that the defendant's intent to cause severe emotional distress exist either because the act was done for the specific purpose of causing that distress, or because the defendant's intent to cause severe emotional distress exists either because the act was done for the specific purpose of causing that distress, or because the defendant's intent to cause severe emotional distress exists either because the act was done for the specific purpose of causing that distress, or because the defendants knew the daughter was present and watching the beating, nor that the beating was carried out in order to cause her distress, nor that the defendants knew the daughter was present and watching the beating, nor that the beating was carried out in order to cause and mine a remember of causing and watching the beating. The court's conclusion affirmed the dismissal of her claim, establishing what is often called the bystander presence rule. A plaintiff who witnesses harm inflicted on someone else generally cannot recover for intentional infliction of emotional distress unless the defendant was aware of the plaintiff's presence at the time. Mern Section 6. To trust to land, to tarp or compression will infliction of emotional distress unless the defendant was aware of the plaintiff's presence at the time. Urn Section 6, Tal Das to Land. Chair Sex to Land is a stepling benefit about complications in the nits, and I are in presence to see there is ended. I'ms then side alta, I meanly, how maven.
The defendant entered onto the plaintiff's unenclosed land along with a surveyor and chain carriers, and actually surveyed part of it, claiming it as his own, but did not mark any trees, cut any bushes, or otherwise visibly damage the property. The trial judge instructed the jury that this did not amount to a trespass, since no actual physical damage had been proven, and the jury found for the defendant. The plaintiff appealed. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether an unauthorized entry onto another's land constitutes a trespass even when it causes no visible or provable physical damage to the property. The rule the North Carolina Supreme Court announced was that every unauthorized, and therefore unlawful, entry into the close, that is, the possessed land, of another is a trespass, full stop. The law simply infers that some damage results from any such entry, even if it is nothing more than treading down grass or shrubbery. Applying that rule, the court found the trial judge's instruction plainly wrong. The fact that the defendant did not mark trees or visibly damage anything went only to the amount of damages that might be awarded, not to whether a trespass had occurred at all. Unauthorized entry onto the land, for the purpose of surveying it and claiming it as his own, was itself the trespass. The court's conclusion reversed the judgment and ordered a new trial, establishing one of the foundational principles of the tort. Proof of actual physical harm to the land is not required to establish trespass. Only proof of intentional, unauthorized entry. Actual damage merely goes to the size of the damages award, which may be nominal if no real harm is shown. Case: Heron v. Sutherland, Montana, 1925. The defendant, while standing on someone else's land hunting ducks and other migratory birds, repeatedly fired his shotgun at birds flying directly over the plaintiff's own property, his house, his cattle. The plaintiff sued for trespass, seeking only nominal damages of $1. The defendant argued that since he never set foot on the plaintiff's land himself and never physically struck anything on it, there was no trespass at all. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether firing a gun so that the shot or its trajectory passes through the airspace directly above another person's land, without the shooter ever setting foot there and without any object actually landing on the property, constitutes a trespass to that land. The rule the Montana Supreme Court applied drew on the old common law maxim that ownership of land extends upward, in principle without limit, meaning that causing a projectile to pass through the airspace over someone's land, disturbing the quiet, undisturbed, peaceful enjoyment of the property, interferes with the owner's possessory rights just as a physical entry onto the surface would. Applying that rule to the facts, the court found that repeatedly discharging a shotgun over the plaintiff's dwelling, land, and livestock, even without the defendant ever entering the property himself, and even without any shot actually striking anything on it, was itself an interference with the plaintiff's peaceful enjoyment and possession of the land, and therefore at least a technical trespass. The court's conclusion affirmed a judgment for the plaintiff, though only for the $1 in nominal damages that had been requested, illustrating that even a fairly attenuated intrusion into someone's airspace can be a trespass, though the case also flagged, without fully resolving, the harder questions that would later arise with the development of air travel passing at much greater heights over private land. Case: Rogers v. Board of Road Commerce for Kent County, Michigan, 1947. Summary: for 2 winters, the defendant county road commission had obtained the decedent's permission to place a snow fence in his field, using an anchor post to secure it, alongside the road running past his farm area and Acarius and Summerman's airspace can be a trespass, though the case also flagged without for Kent known all in annotations by their any paces army. The case for every nonal and our fairest essentially is again Mulla's tire found the Mose Acarius, I have repressedly. Informations, and is an alley. Case is Wold Road, for it is done in alley. County elevate plainness, as in. His widow sued for wrongful death, alleging the county's continued presence of the post on the land, after its license or permission to be there had expired, amounted to a trespass. The trial court dismissed the case on the pleadings, partly on grounds of governmental immunity. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a party that was initially given permission to place an object on someone's land, but who then fails to remove that object once the permission or license underlying its presence has ended,
can be held liable in trespass for resulting harm, and whether governmental immunity barred the claim. The rule is that a privileged entry or a privileged object's placement on another's land is limited by the scope and duration of the permission granted. Once that license expires or is not renewed, continuing to leave the object there without authorization becomes a trespass, and the party responsible can be held liable for resulting harm flowing from that trespass, without any separate need to prove the party was also negligent in failing to remove it. Applying that rule, the court found that the commission's authority to keep the anchor post in the field was tied to the specific purpose and season for which permission had been given, securing a snow fence during winter, and once that season passed without the post's removal, its continued presence on the land was no longer authorized. The resulting death, caused directly by that unremoved, unauthorized object, was therefore actionable as flowing from a trespass, and the court also found that governmental immunity did not shield the county from this particular claim. The court's conclusion reversed the dismissal and remanded the case for further proceedings, reinforcing that a defendant can be strictly liable in trespass for harm flowing from an unauthorized object left on someone's land, even without a separate showing of negligence in failing to remove it. Makes in 7. Trespass to chattels protects a person's interest in personal property that falls short of the complete dispossession required for the more serious tort of conversion. Unlike trespass to land, this tort generally requires the plaintiff to show some actual harm, either dispossession, damage to the property, deprivation of its use for a substantial time, or harm to some other legally protected interest connected to it. Case: Glidden v. Svibiak, New Hampshire, 1949, in pulling its ears, and that this should bar her recovery under the statute. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a young child's act of climbing on a dog and pulling its ears, with no allegation that the dog was actually harmed or injured by this handling, constitutes a trespass to chattels sufficient to trigger the statutory bar to recovery. The rule is that trespass to chattels requires proof of actual harm, either that the chattel was impaired in condition, quality, or value, that the possessor was deprived of its use for a substantial time, or that harm resulted to the possessor or to some other legally protected interest. Mere harmless handling of another's property, without any showing of resulting harm, does not by itself constitute an actionable trespass to chattels.
Applying that rule, the court found no claim and no evidence that Toby the dog was in any way injured or harmed by the little girl playing with him, climbing on him, or pulling his ears. Whatever the propriety of her conduct, it caused the dog no impairment or harm of the kind the tort requires. The court's conclusion held that, without any harm to the dog, no trespass to chattels had occurred, so the girl was not barred from recovering under the statute for the injuries the dog's bite caused her, establishing the enduring principle that a trespass to chattels claim requires proof of actual harm, unlike the more forgiving no harm required standard that applies to trespass to land. Case, CompuServe Inc. v. Cyber Promotions Inc., SD Ohio, 1997. Problems.
CompuServe installed filtering software to screen out the messages, but Cyber Promotions modified its equipment to circumvent the filters, disguising the true origin of its messages so they could continue CompuServe's system despite the company's explicit objections. CompuServe sought a preliminary injunction based on the theory that this conduct amounted to a trespass to its computer equipment. Its chattels. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether sending a massive, unwanted volume of unsolicited bulk electronic mail to a company's computer servers, over its explicit objection and despite its efforts to block the messages, CompuServe sought a preliminary injunction based on the theory that this conduct amounted to a trespass to its computer equipment. Its chattels. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether sending a massive unwanted volume of unsolicited bulk electronic mail to a company's computer servers, over its explicit objection and despite its efforts to block the messages, past CompuServe installed filtering software to screen out the messages, but their promotions modified its equipment to circumvent the filters, disguising the true origin of its messages so they could continue reaching CompuServe's system. The rule, drawing on the restatement's definition, is that a trespass to chattels may be committed by intentionally using or intermeddling with a chattel in another's possession, and liability follows if that interference dispossesses the owner, impairs the chattel's condition or value, deprives the owner of its use for a substantial time, or causes harm to some other legally protected interest connected to it, none of which requires that the chattel be physically touched or visibly damaged in the traditional sense. Applying that rule, The court found that the enormous volume of unwanted bulk mail placed a real, measurable burden on CompuServe's equipment, consuming disk space and processing power that would otherwise have served its paying subscribers, and as cyber promotions' efforts to disguise its messages and evade CompuServe's filters made the burden even worse by forcing the system to labor over undeliverable mail. The court also found harm to CompuServe's business reputation and goodwill, since many subscribers were canceling their accounts specifically because of the unwanted bulk email flooding their inboxes. The court's conclusion granted CompuServe's motion for a preliminary injunction, holding that this kind of intangible but real interference with a company's systems, diminishing their value and utility even without physical damage, was sufficient to establish a trespass to chattels and warranted extending the earlier restraining order against the defendants for the duration of the case. Deference Section 8. Conversion, rendi glitch, conversion is the more serious cousin of trespass to chattels. It involves an intentional exercise of dominion or control over someone else's chattel so complete or so seriously interfering with the owner's right to control it that the law treats the defendant as having effectively forced a sale of the property to himself and requires the defendant to pay its full value. The single principal case in this section explores the limits of what property and what kind of interference can support a conversion claim. Case, Pearson v. Dodd, D.C. Circuit, 1969. Two former employees of Senator Thomas Dodd, sometimes with help from members of his current staff, entered his office without authorization on several occasions, removed documents from his files, made photocopies of them, and returned the originals to the files before the office reopened the next morning, leaving the physical documents themselves completely undamaged and unmissed. Copies of the documents were passed along to newspaper columnists Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson, who then published articles based on the information they contained. The senator sued, and the trial court granted him partial summary judgment on a theory of conversion, finding that copying and using documents known to have been improperly removed was itself a conversion. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether secretly copying documents from someone's files, without removing, damaging, or permanently depriving the owner of the physical originals, and without profiting from any independent commercial value in the information itself, constitutes conversion of either the physical documents or the information it's carrying. The rule requires that conversion be an intentional exercise of dominion or control over a chattel so serious that it justifies forcing the defendant to pay the chattel's full value, as though there had been a forced sale, a standard that requires substantial, not merely momentary or harmless, interference with the owner's possessory rights, and which generally does not extend to mere ideas or information unless that information itself is independent to pay the chattel's full value, as though there had been a forced sale. A standard that requires substantial, not merely bonus or a friend's, a value in the family, information that may contain mo, asset, anarangema. Applying that rule, the court found that because the physical documents themselves were removed only briefly at night, photocopied and returned completely undamaged before the office reopened, the senator was never substantially deprived of his use of the actual physical files. So there was no conversion of the documents as physical objects. As to the information contained in them, the court found nothing in the record suggesting the documents embodied literary property, scientific invention, secret commercial plans, or anything else the law of conversion has historically protected as property in its own right. They were simply office records and correspondence, disclosure of which the senator might have wished to prevent, but which did not rise to the level of protectable prop conversion purposes. The court's conclusion reversed the trial court's grant of summary judgment on the conversion claim, holding that neither the temporary, undamaging removal of the physical documents nor the disclosure of the information in them supported liability for conversion, while leaving open and remanding for further proceedings the senator's separate claim for invasion of privacy based on the same underlying conduct, and directing 9, Parsec and liability, aiding and abetting and conspiracy. Reflections: the final section of this chapter addresses when a person who did not personally commit a tort can nonetheless be held liable for it, because they knowingly assisted, encouraged, or conspired with the person who did. This is sometimes called participation liability, and it comes in two related forms: liability for civil conspiracy, when there was an agreement to pursue an unlawful object, and liability for aiding and abetting, when a person knowingly and substantially assisted someone else's tortious conduct, even without a formal agreement. Case Halberstam v. Welch, D.C. Circuit, 1983, and Evolver Omo agreement. Case was Halberstam vs. the Nip Hamilton, because of M. Jess the Thury, Miney Moore, case one of these burglaries, Welch broke into Michael Halberstam's home and, in the course of escaping after Halberstam confronted him, shot and killed him. Hamilton was not present at the burglary or the killing, and she claimed at trial that she had no idea Welch's activities were criminal. But the evidence showed that over roughly 5 years she had handled all the financial transactions flowing from his enterprise, deposited buyer's checks into her own accounts, kept records and inventories, typed transmittal letters for sales of melted gold and silver, and enjoyed a rapidly growing unexplained accumulation of wealth, including a $1 million home and matching Mercedes-Benz cars, all while Welch, who had no legitimate outside employment, left the house for several hours almost every evening. Halberstam's widow, sane and natural and with certainly American divorce, typed transmittal letters for sales of melted gold and silver, and enjoyed a rapidly growing unexplained accumulation of wealth. The issue was whether a person who knowingly provides sustained financial and logistical assistance to another person's ongoing pattern of property crime without personally participating in or even knowing about any specific burglary or the killing itself can be held civilly liable for a killing that occurred when her partner was caught in the act and used violence to escape. The rule of the D.C. slide recognizes two related theories of participation liability. Under a conspiracy theory, a defendant who agrees, even tacitly, with another to pursue an unlawful common enterprise is liable for any tortious act committed by a co-conspirator in furtherance of that enterprise's underlying object, even if the defendant neither planned nor specifically knew about that particular act in advance. Under an aiding and abetting theory, a defendant is liable if another party committed a wrongful act causing injury, the defendant was generally aware of her role in an overall illegal or tortious enterprise at the time she provided assistance, and the defendant knowingly and substantially assisted that underlying wrongdoing, with substantiality assessed by weighing the nature of the act assisted, the amount of assistance given, the defendant's presence or absence at the time of the specific tortious act, her relationship to the wrongdoer, her state of mind, and the duration of her involvement. Applying that framework to the facts, the court found it entirely reasonable to infer from the sheer scale and duration of Hamilton's involvement, years of handling all the financial mechanics of a criminal enterprise she must have known, at some level, could not be legitimate. Given Welch's unexplained nightly absences, his stockpiles of stolen goods, and their sudden unexplained wealth, that she had both tacitly agreed to participate in the criminal enterprise and knowingly substantially assisted it, even though she was not present for and did not specifically know about the burglary during which Welch killed Halberstam. Because violence and the risk of a killing during a confrontation is a foreseeable risk inherent in any ongoing pattern of burglary, robbery, or fencing stolen property, her substantial, long-running assistance to that overall criminal enterprise made her liable for the foreseeable consequences of it, including the killing itself, whether analyzed under a conspiracy theory or an aiding and abetting theory. The court's conclusion affirmed the judgment holding Hamilton civilly liable for Welch's killing of Halberstam, establishing the modern framework, later adopted in substance by the Restatement Third of Torts, for when a person sustained knowing assistance to another's tortious enterprise, even without direct involvement in a specific harmful act, is substantial enough to make her legally responsible for it.
Genalistics, end of chapter 2, narration scripture. Nicolama difference powerful of that seconds. Aimed end of chapter 2, narration scripture. Nicolas Moligis. The various defenses, such as consent, self-defense, defense of property, and necessity, that can excuse conduct that would otherwise qualify as one of the intentional torts covered in this chapter.